So currently we're looking at this statement, emptiness is form, which was called the profundity of the conventional, meaning the conventional nature of form. That because of emptiness, because things are empty of independent existence, therefore things can appear and function, meaning that they are dependent arisings. So we had a look at that statement that form is empty, emptiness is form, is saying that because things are empty of independent, that things are empty of independent existence because they are dependent arisings. And we were looking then at what does it mean for something to be a dependent arising, to come into existence dependently. And we saw that we can look at that in three ways or in three levels in terms of things coming to existence depending on causes and conditions, parts, and then labeling. And so we were having a look at those points this morning, and we were coming to try to understand particularly the third point, what does it mean for things to be merely labeled? And by understanding that, that can really help us to understand what we mean by emptiness. Because as we're going to see, particularly in the next two statements, this idea of emptiness and dependent arising are like two sides of a coin. So where we were before we broke for lunch was we were looking at the fact that the person, and we were using the example of cups and pens as the basis for that discussion, was that just as the pen is not the collection of the parts, but the pen is something merely labeled depending on the collection of the parts, likewise, the person is not the parts. The person is not the body and the mind, but the person is something merely labeled on the basis of the body and the mind. And so sometimes this is called the mere I, meaning the I, the person that is merely labeled. So this is the person that exists. And so to move on and to continue on that point a little bit is when we look out on the world, again, to make some sense and meaning out of all of this stuff, we draw lines around various collections of stuff and then turn that collection into a single object and then give it a name because we need to communicate. So, of course, we have to do this line drawing and name giving. And this is what we mean by imputation or labeling. So labeling is not just the fact that there is a single object here that we're giving a name to. There is not a single object here to begin with. There's a collection of lots of stuff. We create the single object by drawing a line around a certain collection of stuff and then give it a name. Now, of course, we have to do this. Otherwise, we can't make any sense of anything. We wouldn't be able to function. So we have to do this. This is not a problem. The problem is that we don't realize this is what we're doing. We think, or not think, experientially, it seems like the world is already divided up into many separate things when we first come into a particular situation. Instantly, there seems like, as soon as I look, there seems like there's six things on this table. That they're there. Separate, discrete things are already there, existing there, independent of my conceptual framework. That's how we experience things. But again, if we stop and reflect for a moment and think about it, we can understand what we've been saying, that actually there's just a lot of data here, and we are really drawing these lines and giving names. Of course, through familiarity, this is so fast we don't recognize that's what we're doing because it's so familiar we just It's just very fast. But again, we can see that this more clearly when we come into a situation that's not familiar with us and we see a lot of data, then we sort of sit there and scratch our heads and go, what's that? And then we can really see how we're trying to make objects or make meaningful chunks out of this. There it becomes a bit more obvious because it's not something familiar. Now, so the problem is, of course, we don't realize this is what we're doing. So we're seeing the world instinctively as already divided into separate things. So really what we're doing is we're turning our line drawing into hard boundaries, that we're seeing the world as made of many boundaries. Now, generally, in most of our experiences, the very first line we draw in experience is we draw a line around here and we conceptually isolate the experiencer because we have single experience. Within single experience, there are two aspects. There's the experiencer and the experienced. And we need to distinguish the two. Otherwise, we couldn't function. And I understand that a newborn baby can't even do that. A newborn baby can't distinguish itself from the world. It has to learn to do that. So, of course, we have to do this. Of course, we have to draw this line and give the name or label me or perceiver or subject or whatever we label. So there is no problem with that. We have to do that to be able to distinguish and make sense of me versus not me, the experiencer versus not experienced. But again, the problem is that we don't realize that's what's happening and we turn this line into a hard boundary. And we believe instinctively that there is this independent experiencer, independent me here, an independent world of experience. So what we're doing is we're contracting around the me part of the experience and sort of splitting ourselves off from the experienced and seeing ourselves as independent of the experienced. And this is called self-grasping. But this self-grasping, this seeing ourselves as independent of the world is completely illogical. And we can see that quite easily if we go back to that example I talked about once or twice before. Is this big? So again, big can't exist on its own, independently. Big only exists depending on small, small on big. Likewise, you can only have up if there's down, in if there's out. Like that, you can only have me if there's not me. How you label that, of course, you can label it you, the world, object, experienced, subject, object, me, world. You can only have me if there's not me. But when we do the self-grasping and we instinctively see there's an independent me, that self-grasping mind is exactly like saying, this is big. It just does not make any sense whatsoever. But that's what we believe in instinctively and relate to in our behavior. And as we saw from those six steps, that leads to our mental afflictions and all of our problems and sufferings. Now, there was a question, I think earlier I mentioned something about ego. And again, generally I don't like to use the word ego because I think even in psychology there are many different ideas about what that word means. So if I start throwing it out there, then maybe there's a lot of mass confusion based on our own individual understanding of that word from different aspects of psychology. But typically when I do use it, I use it in a sense of being the same as self-grasping. That the ego is this self-grasping mind. And that from self-grasping, of course, I'm not suggesting that this is how psychologists would understand the word ego. So I'm not suggesting that at all. It's just that when I use it, how I use it, I tend to use it, in other words, for self-grasping. Then when we have this self-grasping and believing there is this independent me from the world, again, what can quickly follow that is this mind of self-cherishing, that not only am I separate from the world, but I'm the center of the world. Everything revolves around me. My happiness is the most important thing on this planet, more important than the happiness of others. And as we saw briefly the other day, and I think you did a little meditation with Jonas on that, maybe even yesterday, is this self-cherishing mind is really the source of so much suffering. So then, in terms of ego, when I use that, self-cherishing would be unhealthy ego. Meaning that sense of self-cherishing really does lead to a lot of mental afflictions and a lot of suffering. So, of course, I think even in psychology, this idea of selfishness and idea of putting ourselves above others is probably seen as something not very helpful, and we need to overcome that. So I think in psychology, of course, we're trying to make the unhealthy ego a little bit more healthy. But from a Buddhist perspective, as long as we have the self-grasping, we're going to be stuck in samsara. So that, of course, with self-grasping, we can do a lot of good things. In fact, now when we do good things, it's with a self-grasping mind. There is this independent me here trying to help that other person there that seems to exist independent of me. So we can, with self-grasping mind, of course, do a lot of good things. But even if we do good things with the self-grasping, we're still stuck within samsara. So, whereas I think in psychology, the best we can do is to have a healthy sense of ego. In Buddhism, I think we need to go one step further, and that is to get rid of self-grasping altogether, or using this terminology, is to transcend the ego. So that's how I use the word ego when I use it here, just to let you know that. But again, I'm not suggesting that this is how psychology would see the word ego. How different people in psychology use that word, I'm not so sure. But this is how I use it. Now, in many of our actions, we have this strong sense of me. And that self-grasping is quite strong in many of our activities. We tend to often have this perspective in our behavior of me going there, me doing that, me saying this. It's always from this perspective of me, 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 this self-grasping. And again, if we have this strong self-grasping, we become obsessed about me and my happiness, me and my suffering, then as I briefly mentioned already the other day, that can lead to a lot of fear and anxiety because everything out there is a potential threat to me. I better be on guard, build a big wall around ourselves to protect ourselves. We feel lonely and isolated. We end up having a lot of craving and attachment because we believe those things out there could satisfy me maybe, so we have a lot of craving and attachment. And with that, of course, comes frustration and disappointment. And then again, of course, on top of that, we easily can fall into the self-cherishing mode. And then, of course, all those problems we talked about the other day. So I won't mention those again. So again, what's happening is that in our actions, we're contracting around the me part of the experience, and we're having this very much perspective of me doing, me saying, me going. It's always me, 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 me. And while we're contracting around the me, the stronger we are grasping onto the me, the more that we are fighting against reality. Because what we're saying is that we have an interdependent reality, that the experiencer and the experienced are interdependent. But we don't experientially see it in that way. We see and believe that there is an independent me here, independent world here, there. So therefore we are, in our behavior, based on that perspective, we are fighting against reality. And of course, the more that we fight against reality, the more we suffer and we lose, and the people around us suffer and lose as well. But sometimes in our actions, we don't have such strong self-grasping. And this can sometimes happen when we're more focused on the activity rather than the me doing the activity. For example, when we're absorbed in reading a good book, we're absorbed in watching a good film on TV, we're absorbed in solving a problem at work. In those occasions, we are more focused on the activity rather than the me doing the activity. And we know from our own experience in those occasions, things seem to flow a lot easier. Time seems to go very quickly. Why? Because we're more in tune with reality, because this contraction around me is less. We're not so strongly grasping onto the me due to the force of our concentration. So that concentration means the self-grasping is a little bit less, meaning we're not fighting as much against reality, and therefore things seem to flow a lot better. And this is very much highlighted in people who have developed a high level of concentration in their activities. For example, professional musicians, professional artists, professional athletes who have spent thousands of hours of practicing their activity. And due to that practice, they have developed a high level of focus for that activity. And then when they engage in that activity, then due to their practice and high level of ability of focus, then the self-grasping is very much reduced because there's just so much focus on the activity rather than the me doing the activity. To the point where sometimes these people say, there was no sense of me, there was just the music playing. There was just a sporting activity happening. And they report then that they're in the sort of zone or the flow state. And they also report peak performance, optimum performance in that state. Why? Because they're not fighting against reality. They're much more in sync with reality due to the self-grasping being much dormant. Of course, they haven't got rid of self-grasping. All that's happened is that due to the power of their concentration, the self-grasping is very much reduced. So, of course, here we're trying to do more than simply reduce self-grasping through concentration. We're trying to eliminate self-grasping through wisdom, through the emptiness practice. And so if we can put effort into this emptiness practice, if we can come to realize emptiness, particularly directly, we will realize directly there is no independent me here. There is no boundary between me and the world. In fact, we'll realize there's not one single boundary in the entire universe. And then we will be able to develop boundless love and compassion for others. Because now, as long as we feel as if there's a me here and a them there, it's very difficult to fully develop love and compassion for others. But when we realize that there's no boundary or gap between us and anyone else, then this really becomes very spontaneous to have love and compassion for others. So it's said that when we really have this direct realization of emptiness and realize there is no boundary, it's said as a result of that experience, after that, our love and compassion for others will literally explode to a level we never thought possible because of that direct realization. So this is what we really need to do. We need to develop this wisdom of emptiness to eliminate this self-grasping mind. Now, this idea of emptiness, of course, is something not very easy to appreciate. And like many topics in Buddhism, often simple analogies are used to help better understand a more profound topic. And here in the topic of emptiness, there are many analogies used that can be helpful. Personally, I find the analogy of dream to be very helpful, which I've already mentioned a little bit in the context of the Chittamatra view. So here, again, we can say that when we're dreaming, there appears to be a dream me here, and there appears to be an independent, objective dream world out there. Which means that in the dream, if we are faced with pleasant and unpleasant stimulus, then we tend to react in the dream with, of course, attachment, aversion, fear, anger, all the mental afflictions. But if within the dream we suddenly realize that we're dreaming without waking up, which of course is called lucid dreaming, then there will still appear to be an independent dream me, and there will still appear to be an independent dream world out there. But now because we're lucid, we will directly realize that these appearances are deceiving us, that both the dream world and the dream me are not existing as they appear. And we'll realize that this is all a product of the mind. Which means, of course, the dream will continue, but it means our perspective of the dream will be completely different, which would mean that actually it would become almost impossible to develop mental afflictions with our experiences in the dream, and we would enjoy the dream a hell of a lot more. So this view here is saying that the waking world is like a dream, meaning also in the waking world, there appears to be a me here, an independent me here, there appears to be an independent objective world out there, and when we are faced with pleasant and unpleasant stimulus, we react with attachment, aversion, big mess. But if we become lucid in our waking state, by realizing emptiness, then there will still appear to be an independent me and an independent objective world out there. But because of our realization of emptiness, we will realize that these appearances are deceiving us, that like a dream, this world only exists within our conceptual framework, within our of the mind. And therefore, the world will continue, we will continue, but our perspective of the world will be completely different. Which means that if something pleasant or unpleasant occurs in our waking world, again, it would all become almost impossible to react to that with attachment or aversion. So this is an analogy, one of many, that are used to describe or to help understand this view of emptiness dependent arising. So just on that point, I'd like to read a little bit from this book here again, What Makes You Not a Buddhist, where he talks about this idea of the dream and brings in this idea of the two truths, which we had a look at before as well. So this is on page 66. And he calls here, what we call conventional truth, he calls it relative truth. He says, in Buddhist philosophy, anything that is perceived by the mind did not exist before the mind perceived it. It depends on the mind. It doesn't exist independently, therefore it doesn't truly exist. That is not to say that it doesn't exist somewhat. Buddhists call the perceived world relative truth or conventional truth, a truth that is measured and labelled by our ordinary minds. In order to qualify as ultimate truth, it must not be fabricated, it must not be the product of the imagination, and it must be independent of interpretation. Although Siddhartha realized emptiness, emptiness was not manufactured by Siddhartha or anyone else. Emptiness is not the result of his revelation, nor was it developed as a theory to help people be happy. Whether or not Siddhartha taught it, emptiness has always been emptiness. Although paradoxically, we can't even really say that emptiness has always been, because it is beyond time and has no form. Nor should emptiness be interpreted as negation of existence. That is, we can't say that this relative world doesn't exist either, because in order to negate something, you have to acknowledge that there is something to negate in the first place. Emptiness doesn't cancel out our daily experience. Siddhartha never said that something spectacular, better, purer, or more divine exists in place of what we perceive. He wasn't an anarchist refuting the appearance or function of worldly existence either. He didn't say that there is no appearance of a rainbow and that there is no cup of tea. We can enjoy our experience, but just because we can experience something doesn't mean that it truly exists. Siddhartha simply suggested that we examine our experience and consider that it could be just a temporary illusion, like a daydream. If someone asked you to flap your arms and fly, you would say, "I can't," because in our experience of the relative world, it is not physically possible to fly. But suppose you are asleep and dreaming that you are flying through the sky. If someone in the dream says, "Human beings can't fly," you will say, "Yes, I can, see," and you will fly away. Siddhartha would agree on both counts. You can't fly when you're awake, and you can fly when you're asleep. The reasons are the causes and conditions that have and have not come together. A condition necessary to be able to fly is to be dreaming. When it is not there, you can't fly. When it is, you can. If you dream that you are flying and continue to believe that you can fly even after you wake up, that becomes a problem. You will fall and you will be disappointed. Siddhartha says that even when we wake up in the relative world, we are asleep with ignorance, like the palace courtesans on the night he fled his previous existence. When the right causes and conditions come together, anything can appear, but when those conditions are exhausted, the appearance stops. Viewing our experience in this world as a dream, Siddhartha found that our habit of fixating on the mere appearance of our dreamlike relative world, thinking that it is truly existing, throws us into an endless cycle of pain and anxiety. We are in a deep sleep, hibernating like a silkworm in a cocoon. We have woven a reality based on our projections, imagination, hopes, fears, and delusions. Our cocoons have become very solid and sophisticated. Our imaginings are so real to us that we are trapped in the cocoon. But we can free ourselves simply by realizing that this is all our imagination. There must be infinite ways to wake up from this sleep. Even substances like peyote and mescaline might give us a vague notion of the illusory aspect of reality. But a drug cannot provide total awakening, if only because this awakening is dependent on an external substance. And when the effect of the mescaline is gone, the experience is gone as well. Suppose that you are having a really bad dream. All it takes is a flicker of realization that you are dreaming to wake you up. The spark can come from within the dream. When you do something anomalous within the dream, you may be jostled into realizing that you are asleep. Peyote and mescaline can spark a short-lived realization by revealing the power of the mind and the imagination. Hallucinations help us temporarily recognize how tangible and believable illusions can be. But such substances are not advisable because they provide only an artificial experience, one that can actually harm the body. Instead, we should have the aspiration to wake up once and for all, without depending on external input. We are much better off when realization comes from within. What we really need is to wake up from our habitual patterns, imagination, and greed. Mind training and meditation are the swiftest, safest, and most effective ways to work within the mind stream. As Siddhartha said, you are your own master. Moving on from that, what I'd like to do now is talk a little bit about something that we've briefly touched on a few times, and that is the fact that for us there are only two possibilities. Either there is this independent me, an independent world, or there's no me and no world. Because the only me and world that we've experienced there in our entire life is independent me, independent world. So again, what often happens is when we come to investigate this supposed independent me and independent world that seems to be here, and we do the investigation well, and we don't seem to be able to find this independent me or independent world, then often we flip to the other extreme of nihilism. Believing that because we can't find this me or find the world, there's no me and no world. So these are the two extremes that we're trying to avoid. And we're going to look at this, and there's a chart in your handout, I think towards the back, called Avoiding the Two Extremes. Yeah, so again, if we stop and think about it, we can understand that big depends on small, and it's ridiculous that we can have a perceiver without a perceived in that. Intellectually, we can sort of appreciate that. But is that how we are instinctively behaving in our life? I think not. We're instinctively sensing, like instinctively when we walk in the door, instinctively there seems to be a cup already existing here on the... Yeah, well, anything, really.
Yeah.
You know, as soon as we see another person, instinctively there's a person already there, independent before I came along. That's our... So, again, if our behaviour was driven by our intellectual understanding, it would be easy to overcome all of our problems.
Yeah.
But, again, our behaviour is not driven by our intellectual understanding. That's why it's not just good enough to get a good understanding of emptiness and dependent arising. Mm-hmm. We can be the smartest person in the world and have huge suffering. In fact, sometimes it's like that. Because these smart people think, oh, I know the answer. I know for sure that this is how things are. And yet, they're still suffering. And so then they get completely depressed because they've got the answer, but somehow it's not fixing anything. No? So, we need to, of course, bring this intellectual understanding into experience through meditation and integrating in daily life. If we can experientially see things in this way, then our life would dramatically improve. And of course, the Buddhist assertion is if we take that to the conclusion, we can achieve a state completely beyond all suffering. Yeah. So, avoiding the two extremes, and in this chart, the term used is permanence and annihilation. Another way of talking about the two extremes or labeling them is existence and non-existence. And of course here, in the two extremes, within the Prasangika school, which we are looking at, the extreme of existence would be grasping onto the fact that things are independent or inherently existence. So this would be inherent existence. This is the extreme. And of course, non-existence is annihilation, or we can say nihilism. That nothing exists. Now, every school, of course, in Buddhism, I mean, even though the school we're following is the Majjhimika, which is called the middle way school, meaning middle way between the two extremes, of course, every philosophical school in Buddhism claims to have the middle way. Every one of those schools claims that their view of reality will enable us to avoid these two extremes. The two extremes, another way of putting this extreme is that we superimpose a level of reality that's not there. We're adding something extra which is not there in reality. So sometimes this is called the extreme of superimposition, meaning we're making things more solid than they really are. And this extreme, of course, of non-existence is we are denying the level of existence that's actually there, meaning we're taking away what's the level of existence that's actually there. So sometimes this is called like deprecation, superimposition and deprecation. To deprecate something is to deny actual level of existence. So all of these schools, of course, claim that they avoid these two extremes. And what we can see if we look at these schools, and I don't want to go into this detail, but if we sort of put it on a little chart, is the Vaibhashika school, and this line here represents stronger level of existence and less. So this would be the extreme of existence here for Vaibhashika, and down here somewhere, they would say that if you accept this, you've gone to the extreme of non-existence or nihilism. So for Vaibhashika, this is the middle way. This is how things actually exist. Now the thing is, we are probably now camped up here somewhere. We're grasping onto things being a little bit like this. We're probably somewhere here. So if we look at the Vaibhashika view, we can move a little bit up. It's easy to relate to because we're close to that. And so by understanding Vaibhashika view, we can move to this point, that this is how solid things are. Then if we go to the Sautrantika school, what we see is that what the Vaibhashikas say as the middle way, the Sautrantikas would say, no way, whoa, that's too much. The goalposts are here. So for Sautrantika, it's there. And so Sautrantika would say the middle way is somewhere here, And so if we understand Satrantika view, we can move from here to here. And then the Chittamatrans, if we look at that, they also say this more or less the same thing. They say what the Satrantikas is how things exist. They say, no, that's way too much. That's actually the extreme of existence you are stuck in. And the goalposts are down here. And so for Chittamatra, the how things exist are somewhere like this. So then we can move to that point. And then Majjhimikas say, no, 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 you Chittamatrans. What you think how things exist, that's way too solid. That's like the extreme of existence. So that's the extreme, and here, and the middle way is here. So this is the Majjhimikas. Majjhimikas say this is the middle way. So of course, if we are somewhere over here now, and the Majjhimikas say the middle way is this, this is how things exist, and this is non-existence, from that perspective, these seem to be the same thing. We can't distinguish. So that's why, from where we are, and we look at the Prasangika view, it's easy to flip here because they're so close from where we are. Whereas if we appreciate the lower views, we can sort of move ourselves up a little bit and then be somewhere here in our understanding based on the lower schools. And then when we look at the Prasangika view, there seems to be much more of a distinction here, and we can avoid flipping to the extreme of non-existence. So that's why these lower schools' views are like stepping stones to the Prasangika view. So that's why I think it's helpful, to study these lower views and to understand them, because they really can help us move our understanding closer to the Majjhimika view, and then we can really appreciate the Majjhimika view without falling to the extreme of non-existence. Because really, you know, this idea that things are empty of inherent existence, we can sort of mouth these words quite easy, and we may have some sort of superficial appreciation of it, but I think we really don't understand it very well, experientially. And that's why when we try to meditate on it, you know, we freak out because it seems like nothing really exists. Because we tend to be camped over here doing the meditation, and that's the sort of the experience. That's what we can see from these two extremes charts here. Now, more on that. Is, again, each school, and we can see here how each school avoids the two extremes with those different assertions. Within the Prasangika school, of course, how we avoid the extreme of existence is to understand that things are not inherently existent. So the antidote, or the thing that can avoid us falling to the extreme of existence, of course, is our understanding and realization of emptiness. And to avoid the extreme of non-existence, meaning thinking that nothing exists, of course, we can talk about things being dependent arisings. Or, of course, if we're now using the Heart Sutra as the basis, what is helping us to overcome the extreme of existence is the statement, form is empty. What is helping us to overcome the extreme of non-existence is emptiness is form. So again, emptiness does not mean nothing exists, because Because of emptiness, there can be form, because it's a dependent phenomenon. So this statement, emptiness is form, will help us to overcome the extreme of non-existence by understanding that everything is a dependent arising. So you're saying that there can be a school that is
after
Prasangika.
Yeah.
Again, these are just four philosophical schools that developed as a result of the Buddha's teachings and, of course, also people's own experiences. According to at least the Mahayana, this is the order in which of subtlety and the Mahayana schools, particularly also in Tibetan Buddhism, would accept that the most profound view is Prasangika. But this is just these systems. So we as an individual, of course, need to look at these and check them out and try them out and see what we can come up with. No? But, of course, the assertion is that people who have followed the Prasangika view have achieved nirvana and enlightenment. And that's what they report, that they have achieved that goal based on that understanding. But of course, even if they say that, we shouldn't believe them, of course.
Mm-hmm.
We need to check it out ourselves, because blind faith or blind belief in anything is not going to help us. But of course, if someone that we respect and aspire to has told us this is their experience, that can at least inspire us to check it out. You know, that there may be some truth in it, because this person we admire and respect and has said that this is their experience, so that can provide us at least some aspiration to try it out ourselves. Okay. So any questions on that? Is that clear? Okay. Now what I'd like to do is to go on to the next statement, because this is sort of leading us into, in the Heart Sutra, the next two statements. So remember the first two of the four statements, the profundity of the ultimate was form is empty, the ultimate nature of form. The second statement, emptiness is form, conventional nature, profundity of the conventional, the subtle conventional nature of form, of everything, that everything is a dependent arising. So then, of course, we talked about the two truths, ultimate truth and conventional truth. The third and fourth profundity are these two statements here. Emptiness is not other than form. Form is also not other than emptiness. So both of those statements together apply to the third and the fourth. So it's not the third sentence is the third one and the fourth is the fourth. So both of these together imply two things. The first is that the two truths are one entity. So when we see emptiness is not other than form, form is also not other than emptiness. Again, we're here, we can talk about the two truths. Ultimate truth, emptiness. Dependent arising is the conventional truth, that form is a dependent arising. So emptiness and dependent arising are not two separate things, two different things. Because those statements are saying emptiness is not other than form, form is also not other than emptiness. Meaning that two truths are what's called one entity, meaning they're not two separate things. It's not like, what this is saying then is it's not like emptiness is something floating in the air there. That emptiness is some other reality. That emptiness is something different or separate from the world itself. Because emptiness is a quality of each and every phenomena. It's the way in which each and every phenomena exists. Therefore, empty. So we can't have emptiness on its own. So emptiness also is a dependent arising. Because you can only have emptiness if there's emptiness of something. You don't have emptiness on its own. You can only talk about emptiness of cup, emptiness of this, emptiness of that. Because emptiness is a quality of every single conventional phenomenon. Therefore, they are one entity. They're not two different separate things, two different realities. Because sometimes people feel if they realize emptiness, they'll pop into some alternate reality. That's not the case. It just means that we will realize, we will see this one reality in a completely different way. So that is the third statement, that these two sentences together, emptiness is not other than form, form is also not other than emptiness, are saying this, that these two truths are not two separate, different things. But at the same time, they're not one. They're not identical. And that's usually said that the two truths are nominally distinct, meaning they're not identical. Because emptiness is not form. Even though it's sort of in the wording, in the very brief wording, it says emptiness is form. What that really implies is that because of emptiness, there can exist form. So here, nominally distinct means that emptiness and dependent arising are like two sides of a single coin. So two sides of a single coin are not two different things, separate things, because they're two sides of one coin, but they're not identical because they are two sides. So the two truths are like that, two sides of a coin. And so these two statements can help us in understanding or help us to avoid falling to either of the extremes. Because now we tend to believe that either there is this solid independent me, solid independent world, or there's no me and no world. So when we come to experience emptiness, often we flip to the other extreme of nihilism. And so for us, as a beginner, it seems like functioning world and emptiness are contradictory. Either there is a functioning world that has some sort of essence, or there's no world. So for us, functioning world and emptiness appear to be contradictory. But as we improve our practice, and we'll come to understand that they're not contradictory, but in fact complementary. They are two sides of a coin. And that's what this statement really means. Emptiness is not other than form. Form is also not other than emptiness. And so one way we can understand that we have got to this understanding is, you know, normally we would say at the beginning level, you know, that emptiness and functioning world are contradictory. But what we'll appreciate when we really deepen our experience of emptiness and dependent arising is that because things are empty, they can function. And because things function, they must be empty of independent existence. Because if this, as I mentioned earlier, if this cup had some inherent nature of being the cup, you couldn't create it, you couldn't change it, you couldn't function. But because it does not have any inherent nature of being a cup, therefore we can create it, it can function, and it can be destroyed. So that is a measure of that our practice is really getting well, is that our realization of emptiness will reinforce the idea that things are dependent phenomena. And our understanding that things are dependent phenomena will reinforce our understanding of emptiness. So that's what these two statements are helping us. And so by this stage of the path, which again we're talking about path of accumulation, path of preparation, we have this understanding now. We are really understanding that emptiness and dependent arising are like two sides of a coin. By the time we got to this point of the path, and each one is really improving the other. Any questions about that before we go for afternoon tea? Everyone's either completely confused or everyone wants a hot cup of tea. Either way, let's have a cup of tea.